Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Right now I can look out my bedroom window and just see the smoke billowing up right over here on the horizon.
Residents of St. Mary's prepare to evacuate as a tundra fire continues to burn. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 9th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the state prepares to distribute COVID vaccines for young children.
The vaccine goes to a tribal health organization, and they redistribute that vaccine to villages.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The special primary election for U.S. Representative is June 11th by mail, and an application is not needed. Ballots will start to be sent April 27th. Voters receive the same ballot regardless of political affiliation, and all candidates are on the ballot. The top 4 vote-getters move on to the special general election. Ballots must be mailed, signed, and postmarked by June 11th. More at elections.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
A lawsuit alleges Alaska's special primary election for U.S. House deprives voters who are visually impaired of the ability to cast ballots privately and independently. The election is being conducted primarily by mail. The lawsuit was filed on behalf of the executive director of the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights. It asks a judge to bar state elections officials from certifying the results of the special primary until visually impaired voters are given a, quote, full and fair opportunity to participate. The Department of Law says it is reviewing the lawsuit. It says the Division of Elections has systems in place to help all voters exercise their right to vote. And that special primary election for U.S. House ends Saturday. This is the race with 48 candidates. We can't feature all of them, but Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin has this overview of the 3 candidates who raised the most money, plus one who hasn't raised any.
In a race this crowded, name recognition matters, and Sarah Palin has it. Fans lined up to have their picture taken with her at a campaign rally at an Anchorage church that featured Donald Trump by telephone.
But she did a phenomenal job and really became a MAGA warrior.
Palin let it be known she's a regular Alaskan. She name-checked local supermarkets and, as she blamed President Biden for gas prices, emphasized that she drives a pickup.
My F-150, $140 out there in Wasilla to fuel it up, the F-150. And it's not even the hottest souped-up model either, but I know you guys, too. You see that every time you fuel up.
For all her fame, Palin has what pollsters call high negatives. Even some conservatives resent all the national attention her campaign has attracted. But there's little doubt that she'll survive the special primary. The top 4 vote-getters will advance. In the special general election, voters will rank them 1 through 4. If that sounds confusing to you, well, you're not alone. We've never voted this way before. Also, the ranked choice special general election to fill the remainder of the late Congressman Don Young's term is on the same day as the regular primary when voters pick who will advance to the November ballot. Another conservative in the race has a familiar name. Sort of.
Nick Begich here, running for Congress for the state of Alaska.
That's Nick Begich III. His grandfather, also named Nick Begich, held Alaska's U.S. House seat until 1972 when his chartered plane disappeared on a flight to Juneau. Nick III has an uncle who was a U.S. senator and another who's a state senator. But those Begiches are Democrats. This one's a Republican. At a candidate forum, Begich credited his mother's side of the family for that.
And a lot of people ask, well, how in the heck does a Begich become a Republican? Raised Republican. My grandparents were Bible Belt Southern Republicans from Southeast Missouri.
Begich doesn't have Trump's endorsement, but he has substantial support from Trump-loving conservatives. It's become an Alaska parlor game to guess who else makes it to the final four. Maybe it will be an Alaska Native candidate. Republican Tara Sweeney and Democrat Mary Peltola have relevant government experience. Or one of the current legislators, Josh Rivak or Adam Wohl. Former Senator John Coghill has a name many people recognize. And if familiarity matters, the Anchorage Daily News has been publishing attorney Jeff Lowenfeld's name and photo since 1976 next to his weekly gardening column.
I'm Al Gross. I'm not a Democrat or a Republican.
Surgeon and commercial fisherman Al Gross still has a ton of name recognition and fundraising strength from his U.S. Senate campaign 2 years ago when he was the Democratic nominee. He's emphasizing his support for abortion rights and more oil production. In fundraising appeals, he pitches himself as the candidate who can defeat Palin. This time, though, the Democratic Party has broken with him for suggesting he could caucus with either party in the House. To the left of Gross is Santa Claus, the North Pole City Councilman. He's one of the only candidates who unequivocally opposes both the Ambler Road and drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
I say leave it alone. Defend the sacred. Protect the Arctic Refuge.
Claus is running a $400 campaign, and he's only in the special. He says Alaska needs a full-time lawmaker in Congress for the rest of the year, not someone still on the campaign trail.
The other advantage for yours truly is, should the voters put me in for at least the 4 or 5 months, I would be in there over the holiday season, and I think a lot of children would get kind of a kick out of it.
At least one pollster says he has a decent chance of being in the final four. If Santa Claus and Sarah Palin make it past the primary this weekend, you can count on seeing more national attention on this race. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska House Majority Leader Chris Tuck says he will not seek re-election this year. The Anchorage Democrat cites a redistricting map that put him in House and Senate districts in which he would have to run against friends and fellow Democratic lawmakers. Tuck filed to run for an Anchorage House seat for which Representative Andy Josephson also filed. Tuck withdrew yesterday. And if Tuck had run for state Senate, he would have been in a district with Senator L.V. Gray Jackson. The filing deadline was last week. Tuck was first elected to the House in 2008. He says he looks forward to spending more time with his children. Two communities along the lower Yukon River are preparing residents to evacuate. A tundra fire is burning less than 8 miles from St. Mary's and Pitka's Point, and wind continues spreading the fire closer to the villages. Over 700 people live in both communities combined. The city of St. Mary's and its two tribes held a community meeting this afternoon. Resident Geraldine Beans said community leaders chose an optional evacuation for elders and people who are considered vulnerable. Other residents will have to wait. Beans has lived in St. Mary's her whole life. This is the first time she's ever heard about the village being evacuated due to a tundra fire.
Right now I can look out my bedroom window and just see the smoke billowing up right over here on the horizon.
Beans says she and her family won't be evacuating just yet, even though her husband is an elder. She says if the fire reaches the village, her family and others will leave by boat.
We noticed a lot of people today getting their boats ready, getting gas, and bringing tents and sleeping bags and water and stuff down to their boat so they'll be ready to go out to a safer spot.
Beans said for now, though, they're holding out.
We're doing good right now, and so far we're not in panic mode.
Jeremy Zedek is the spokesperson for the Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. He said workers at the health clinic in St. Mary's are calling vulnerable residents and asking if they want to evacuate. He said in most instances, the state defers to local leaders to declare evacuation orders. Zedek says the evacuees will be housed at the Bethel Armory. As of 3 p.m. today, all Ute commuter service flights across the region were canceled. Ute is sending all its planes to St. Mary's to evacuate residents. A Ute spokesperson says the airline will evacuate children and elders first. Another regional airline, Grant Aviation, is on deck to also provide planes for evacuation if needed. Prime fire conditions exist across most of the region. The National Weather Service has issued a red flag warning for almost the entire Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta and the Bristol Bay region. The warning means that the area is experiencing or could soon experience critical fire weather. The area is facing hot, dry conditions and has seen large amounts of lightning. The warning is in effect until 11 p.m. tonight. The Arcana Creek fire near the village of Aleknagik is now contained. The fire was discovered Tuesday, and the Division of Forestry hopes to have it fully extinguished by Friday morning. Division of Forestry Public Information Officer Jacob Welsh says four additional smoke jumpers joined the crew already there for a total of eight staff working to suppress remaining hotspots.
What they're finding is little areas of heat. So they're gridding, which means kind of lining out in a row and walking across the landscape to try to find any areas of heat, and then they'll extinguish that.
According to the Katmai National Park website, the Contact Creek fire has surpassed 8,000 acres as of Wednesday. That fire's most active fronts are on its northwestern, southern, and eastern borders. Smoke continues to affect the Bristol Bay region from the surrounding fires. The Dillingham Fire Department recommends the public close windows, wear an N95 mask when outside, and to stay indoors when possible. A burn ban is still in effect in Dillingham. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, inflation drives up grocery bills in rural Alaska.
And then we ended up getting bananas, which were $5.32 a pound. So it was like $7 for that bunch of bananas.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The Biden administration outlined its vaccine rollout plan for young children today. Federal regulators could authorize the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines for kids under age 6 as soon as next week. 10 million doses are currently available for states and health providers to pre-order, according to the White House. Matthew Bobo, Alaska's immunization program manager, says the state has pre-ordered about 27,000 doses. He expects the first half of that order to be delivered on June 20th. There are about 47,000 kids under 5 in Alaska, according to the state health department. But judging by the demand for vaccines for older kids, Bobo thinks they've ordered enough for now.
We definitely think this is adequate vaccine to meet the population demand.
Vaccines for kids 5 to 11 first became available in November. By mid-January, 25% of Alaskans aged 5 to 11 had received at least one dose. That number hasn't risen much since then. Bobo says he expects a similar trend for the youngest group.
I think that we'll see some really, parents that want to get their children vaccinated in the front of the line and the first to get the vaccines in arms. And then I think there'll be a lull.
In its announcement, the Biden administration outlined efforts to reach children in rural communities. In Alaska, Bobo says tribal partners have been key to getting vaccines out to villages throughout the pandemic.
The vaccine goes to a tribal health organization, to a hub, and they redistribute that vaccine and they break it down to send it out to villages. And so we've really standardized the shipping for our tribal health organization partners, so we're able to get out to remote communities fairly easily.
Alaska's Department of Health will host an online presentation on June 28th to provide information and answer parents' questions. COVID cases in the state increased by 26% this week compared to last week. Life in the small island communities of Southeast Alaska may feel isolated, but in reality, no place is safe from the ripple effects of a globalized economy. In Cake, a village of about 500, residents are feeling the squeeze of inflation especially hard as transportation costs have driven up the price of food and basic necessities to unimaginable levels. But as KCAW's Tosh Kimmel reports, locals are refining old strategies and developing some new ones to stay ahead of inflation.
As any Alaskan will tell you, life in the 49th state isn't cheap. But for those living in remote villages and especially island communities, prices can be astronomical. In Cake, a village on Kuprinoff Island, it's no different. Something lifelong resident Chelsea Lewis has come to terms with.
Food is one of those things that we kind of, as a family, just know that we're going to have to spend money on. And so that's one of those things we don't really, we try not to think about too much, because if you thought about it too much here, we'd probably move.
Lewis and her husband run a YouTube channel chronicling their life in rural Alaska. While their content ranges from Q&As to fishing trips, their most popular videos document their grocery hauls. In one with over 40,000 views, Lewis shows us what $600 gets her at the local grocery store in Cake.
I'm just going to go through some of the things that are kind of more expensive and show you what that looks like. This cheese here was $17.98, and then this one was $30. So I think cheese is probably the most expensive thing.
But it's not just cheese that comes with a sticker shock.
And then we ended up getting bananas, which were $5.32 a pound. So it was like $7 for that bunch of bananas.
As Lewis explains, there's many factors that go into the village's high food costs.
Everything comes to us from Seattle. During that whole time it's on the barge, it has to be refrigerated. Anything that's refrigerated or frozen is really a lot more expensive.
But it's not just local circumstances affecting the community's inflation rate. The price of food reached an all-time high this March as a consequence of global supply chain breakdown, rising energy prices, and the war in Ukraine. In rural southeast Alaska, where the majority of goods are barged in, higher fuel costs mean higher food costs and fewer available items. But even for those who do shop locally, timing is everything. Go to the store too late and you could miss out on even the most basic necessities.
The barge comes in on like Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, and if you're not there on Wednesday, you're probably not going to get milk or eggs usually. So
that's Lewis's young daughter, Bonnie.
Yeah, the last time we bought like a gallon of milk, it was like $9. And then my husband went to go get milk on, I think, Friday, and they were already out of like the regular gallon size. So we had to buy like two like small quart sizes. And then so that's even more. So it's like $10 for two little quart sizes.
To get around the high prices and scarcity issues, it's not unheard of for rural Alaskans to travel hundreds of miles to the nearest city just to grocery shop. In Lewis's case, a shopping trip to Juneau every few months is just another reality of life in the village. Greta Healy recently relocated to Cake for a job. She's learning to live off the village's limited options, so during a recent trip to the larger neighboring island town of Sitka, she decided to stock up on food.
I was taking the ferry so I could bring a bunch of food with me, which was really sweet. Yeah, I mean, I tried to buy all the food for the next month because I'm not leaving for a month.
I mean, there's definitely a cost of living unique story in Alaska. You know, the difference in the cost of living between urban and rural, you know, rural and village. And, you know, there's dramatic differences there.
Neil Freed is an economist with the Alaska Department of Labor. He says relief from inflation is coming, but it may be a ways down the road.
Hard to predict what's going to happen to inflation. But when we look at the national numbers and we look at our numbers and we look at these most recent numbers, it appears that inflation will remain high again in 2022, even if it does begin to moderate towards the end of the year.
That means food costs will reach record highs, especially in rural and village communities of Alaska. And unfortunately, supply even more content for Chelsea Lewis's YouTube channel. Reporting in Cake, Alaska, I'm Tosh Kimmel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The special primary election for U.S. Representative is June 11th. Voters will automatically receive a ballot in the mail starting April 27th. No regular polling places will be open on Election Day. You will vote for only one candidate, and you must return your ballot by June 11th with your signature, identifier, and a witness signature. If you will not be at your current mailing address or do not receive a ballot, contact the Division of Elections. You can vote in person at the Division's regional offices beginning May 27th. Offices will be open on weekdays between 8 and 5, on weekends with limited hours, and on Election Day between 7 and 8. For the full schedule and a list of additional in-person voting locations, visit the Division's website at akvoteearly.alaska.gov. For assistance in Alaska Native languages, please call 1-866-954-8683. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Elections.
The state has begun selling land in an area near Nenana that it's developing for agriculture. Alaskans interested in farming or ranching can find out more about the land sales Friday during the annual Nenana Agricultural Day, and Saturday when prospective buyers will be able to get out and take a first-hand look at the land. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The state began accepting bids last week for the first land sales in the Nenana Tochacket Agricultural Project.
We have 27 lots ranging from around 21 acres to just a little over 300 acres that are going to be available for sale.
Agriculture Division Director Dave Shady says about 2,000 acres are available in this long-awaited land offering, with lots costing around $500 an acre. He says it's the first of many land sales that'll take place in the 100,000-acre ag project over the next 3 decades, and Alaskans interested in this first sale have until October 4th to submit bids.
So people have a lot of time to look at it, look at the values for themselves, and figure out how they might want to submit a bid.
They'll get a great opportunity to do that on Saturday when the Ag Division and other state agencies will hold an open house out on the Tochacket.
We'll have people out there. You can see the soil pits. You can actually look and talk to the soil scientists.
Shady says the soil and drainage and relatively long growing season are some of the reasons that the Tochacket is such an ideal place to develop the state's next big agriculture project.
This is really good topsoil, got a sandy layer underneath it.
He says preserving that topsoil is one of the environmental stewardship measures that the Ag Division will require of those who buy land in the Tochacket.
We don't have any pesticides. We don't have that kind of stuff. We're starting with raw land. Now, that means that we got to work and really make sure we don't have invasives and we don't have things that come in that require the herbicides, the pesticides.
Shady says the other concept on which the ag project is being developed is economic viability. That's why there's a 30-year time frame for land sales and why they'll offer different sized parcels.
If you're doing something with greenhouses, 20 acres is plenty. But if you're doing a ranch, you're going to need land for the cattle to graze. You're going to need land for fields for raising the hay and the crops and the grain.
Prospective farmers and ranchers can talk about all that with experts that'll be available beginning Friday during Nenana Agriculture Education Day, to be held in town at the 10th Street Boat Launch parking area. Shady says having state and federal officials on hand will give the buyers a chance to talk directly to the experts.
These people are usually spread around the state. When you can go and talk to one who can refer you to the other one that's literally two tables over, it is really going to help the farmers, the community, people that are interested in knowing what the opportunities and what the programs are right there.
You can find out more about the 2022 Alaska State Agricultural Land Offering by going to the Ag Division's homepage or its Facebook or Twitter feeds. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
A group of researchers is hoping that data collected from the Gulf of Alaska's seafloor will shed new light on the environmental effects of bottom trawling. KMXD's Kirsten Dobrath reports.
Scientists from the conservation group Oceana spent 8 days aboard a research vessel circumnavigating the Kodiak Archipelago late last month. John Warinchuk is a senior scientist and fisheries campaign manager with Oceana.
The Gulf of Alaska is a very special place and a very productive ecosystem. Our timing of our survey here in the spring means we saw just the abundance of life from the phytoplankton to the fish, to the birds feeding at the surface.
The focus of the trip, though, was documenting life at the very bottom of the sea to better understand the impacts of commercial bottom trawling, according to Warinchuk. He says the group sent cameras and remotely operated vehicles down to depths more than 1,000 feet deep at some sites and photographed areas of the seafloor that had never been seen before.
We chose sites to explore that were both open and closed to bottom trawling. And we did see differences between those types of sites.
Warinchuk says researchers documented coral gardens and groves of sea whips. But the group also saw evidence of heavy damage to the ocean floor, including areas of crushed coral where trawling is permitted. Warren Chuck says they don't know what those areas of the seafloor looked like before trawlers arrived, but they're planning to submit their observations to the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council and the National Marine Fisheries Service. They're in the midst of an essential fish habitat management review process for the area, and Warren Chuck hopes the photos and videos from the water off Kodiak will help make the case to keep trawlers out of some areas of the ocean.
So much of the ocean has remained unexplored that any information we gather on seafloor habitat characterization, locations of sensitive habitats, that'll only help us make better fishery management decisions moving forward.
The Essential Fish Habitat Summary Report is slated to come out in October of this year. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
A dozen volunteers cleaned up popular trails in Chugach State Park in Anchorage this past weekend in honor of National Trails Day. It was one of many Trails Day work parties across the state. The day-long event is designed to help maintain some of the most popular park routes in the city. Alaska Public Media's Laura Fillion hiked to a work party at the Glen Alps Trailhead and has this story.
A short way up the Flat Top Trail, next to a dirty patch of melting snow, Caitlin Payne demonstrates to a group of volunteers how to cut away brush.
And something like this that's sticking out, you want to get rid of that as well because if a dog hits it or a person walks up, it'll really hurt. So that was a poor cut on my part. So you just want to go as close to the main branch as possible.
Steve Cleary watches nearby. He's the director of Alaska Trails, who organized this event. He says the Trail Stewards Program started as a way to give back.
Our Alaska Trail Stewards Program started about 7 years ago right here in Chugach State Park, and our mission still remains to help land managers do the maintenance on trails that they aren't able to do so people can get out and enjoy the trails they love.
Over the off-season, says Cleary, alders choked the lower trail to Flat Top Mountain. Then, under the weight of winter snow, they bent into the path. Cleary and his team of volunteers want to make sure they don't cause injuries to anyone using the trails.
What happened over the winter time is it really got choked off when the snow bent the alders down. Then sometimes those got clipped and now they're posing a danger because they're sticking 2 feet out of the ground.
The trails around Anchorage have also faced increased usage since the beginning of the pandemic. Cleary says traffic is a consideration for maintenance as well.
All throughout COVID, people have been using trails as a way to get out and stay active, but that has increased the use and increased the need for maintenance. So we really want to do our part to help make sure that those trails are well-maintained and people can enjoy them.
Kathy and Craig Knutson volunteered for the day. They also helped build the new Little O'Malley Trail at Glen Alps last year. Kathy Knutson says it was satisfying to see their work pay off when they walked that route at the end of the summer.
So many people are out here using the trails. It really feels good to give back and help maintain them.
Knutson says she was happy to be helping out again. In Anchorage, I'm Laura Fillion.
Well, that's the end of the trail for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin and Laura Fillion in Anchorage, Olivia Eberts and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Tosh Kimmel in Sitka, and Kirsten Dobrath in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.